And a very, very warm welcome to Mia Caliph, who's talking to us from the west coast of Canada. And Mia's going to be running a course for us starting on the 1st of March at 7 p.m. UK time. And it's the first time we've had Mia on our birth journey. So we're really delighted to have you here, Mia. Thank you for being here. So just to give a bit of background about Mia, I've had her book, The Secret Life of Babies, for quite a long time. And as you can see, it's well thumbed. And Mia is with her background was as a chiropractor and also as a craniosacral therapist, and has specialized in working with mums and babies for many years now. And she founded the Emerging Families, a center for therapy, research and education for the primal period. And she also developed the Intuitive Recovery Project, which actually we're going to talk a little bit about tonight, hopefully as well, Mia, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Which offers modules for opening the senses to relational intimacy with nature, self, and others. So welcome, Mia.
Thank you, John.
For being here. That's great.
Pleasure.
Can I just ask how you got interested in this work? Because I know for a lot of us working in this field, it was a sort of personal interest about our own birth history that got us into this work. Was that the same for you?
Yeah, I was thinking you'd probably ask that question, and it's true. Anyone who's interested in healing usually has had something go a little bit awry in their life and they want to write it somehow. So it's definitely my story too. I was, an amateur athlete and a dancer as a child and teenager, and found myself injured quite often. So I was having all these opportunities to learn about anatomy and physiology and radiology every time I would hurt myself. But what I didn't realize is the underlying conditions that were causing those injuries were much older, much more subtle, and had not yet been uncovered. And some of them had to do with pre-birth and birth experiences. So as I got into the healing arts, I started to discover my own history as well, which happens for many of us. So it's the healer healed by thyself.
That was interesting about, so you're with your, because you often find with clients that they continually say injure themselves on the same side of their body or in a particular kind of way. You know what I mean? There seems to be some sort of history there. Was that true with you as well?
Yeah, I think there was. I probably only started to notice those patterns as I got more experienced as a practitioner, though. But, certainly, and I know you see this too, probably in your practice and in your teaching, that we have themes that we seem to come in with that we revisit from different camera angles throughout life and have more opportunities to deepen with. And after a while, it sometimes appears that they're not actually problems or tragedies, but really rather windows through which we start to perceive ourselves through and grow ourselves through.
Yeah. So how did you begin to relate those back to perhaps early experience like birth or pre-birth? Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember the first time I ever had a glimmer that those early experiences mattered. I was probably about 19 years old and I'd had a rowing injury. I used to row competitively. And I had gone through a series of practitioners, all who tried to help me, none of which really led anywhere. And then finally, I was with the chiropractor who said, let's do a visualization. Why don't you come in? We'll book some extra time. And I was so scared. I didn't know what was going to happen. And all I did was breathe while he worked on releasing some muscles of breathing in my body. And probably after 15 minutes or so, I started to have images come to mind. These are things I never thought could happen or didn't really know what they were. It was a very innocent kind of first experience of regression. And I saw myself as a baby in the womb and I felt some sadness and tears started to come. But as the tears came, the pain alleviated. And, at that age, it was a real epiphany that emotional trouble can contribute to physical pain. So that really set me on the course, set me on the path of, wow, there's so much more to pain than the physical. There must be the emotional. And it made me want to become a chiropractor so I would have the license to do this kind of exploration.
What were you doing before that? What was your history before you got into this work?
Well, like I said, I was a teenager and mostly into sports and dance. And my mother was a very active physical person. She really brought aerobics to the city we lived in. And she was a real leader in that way and a dancer. And so I was always very body oriented, but I pretty much took the path of being a healer almost from the get-go. And I enjoyed writing as well. So now I get to do both.
Fantastic. I was reading in this book, just revisiting before this, and you talk quite a lot about the different principles, don't you? And I know, like, one of the principles, I think it's the fourth principle, is around how you can heal birth or pre-birth at any age, right? And that's what this course is about, isn't it?
Yeah, it's and I know you know this too. It's just amazing how we can time travel, how the consciousness of having been an embryo or having been a baby, even though chronologically has come to its end, somehow we're still able to revisit that space given the right conditions. Mm. And, you know, in classical therapy, we call it regressing. And in shamanic work, we would just say that we're entering into a different field or a different state of consciousness. Mm. And so, you know, some of my own mentors here in North America used to say that if we get ourselves into the right conditions of like a well-functioning family, where we slow down and we make good contact with each other and we act as though we care, we behave as though we care, we come into right relationship with each other, then these very tender and subtle and soft and vulnerable memories sometimes have an opportunity to come out and speak what they've never been able to speak before. Mm. And certainly in a large group, it's not always easy to tend to the uniqueness and the particulars of each person. You know, sometimes we work in a group online that's 80 people or 40 people. And so the pandemic has really given an occasion to think about how to do large group work in a very safe and still a very personal way without necessarily being able to tend to every detail for every person.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're going to do in the course.
Wonderful. Yeah. That sounds great. And certainly in my experience, a lot of these memories, you could call them, whatever they are, obviously that, you know, the body remembers everything, doesn't it? And so a lot of these mm-hmm. memories seem to be quite physical or physical sensations, mm-hmm. which we might interpret in certain ways. So it tends mm-hmm. to start with the body, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some of them can be, I mean, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about one of the principles you talk about, which is about memory. This is something of a fascination of mine. We had a conversation with Anna Verwal about this as well. You know, like when does memory begin? And mm-hmm. How is it possible that the body can remember things even when before a nervous system is formed? And I know you talk a bit about this in the book as well.
Yeah, it's very fascinating, isn't it? It's I think that to enter the conversation, it inevitably becomes philosophical and theological, you know, in a way, a conversation, because it starts to defy our common scientific materialistic way of being in the world, where we assume that, that mind is in the brain and that all things are tangible, linear. There are so many tenets that get thrown up in the air when we start to have this conversation. So I just dive in and assume that it's okay to have the conversation. I don't worry too much about the naysayers, but that title of that chapter is that we have consciousness precedes the brain architecture that is thought to support it.
Yeah.
And I think when I started noticing people having memories of their conception or implantation, the very first time they come into relationship with their mother at the endometrial lining, it begs the question, how can they know that? How can they still feel that? And so I really like turning to Rupert Sheldrake's theories on morphic resonance to help understand that, where he says memory isn't just in the cells, it isn't just in the brain, it's actually in the field, a field of resonance that crosses space and time. And it helps us understand too why people two or three generations later still have a felt sense of a trauma that came from their ancestors, like we know about in Holocaust survivors and their descendants. So how is it that we can have the memory of starvation if our families went through the potato famine, or, you know, all these different cultural tragedies and large experiences have sent a vibration through space and time. So as infants and as babies and babies in the womb, I think that we are resonating rather than housing memory. We're resonating with something that is, that can cross membranes, cross cells, cross bodies, space and time. And when we do the healing work, if we can resonate with something that can create coherence for that resonance, whether that is solely in us or between us and our mother or us across a generation or an ancestral line, we can really very gently and effectively integrate that trauma.
Well, one of the things that's occurred to me recently is, I want to touch on a little bit more, go into a bit more depth about when you say it's never too late to heal, and how our nervous systems respond to certain, you know, could be traumatic events. But one thing that it occurs to me, because I'm sure you've seen this in your practice, you have, you know, you can have a baby who has apparently gone through the most horrendous experiences and will be very kind of okay, you know, very resilient and kind of bounce back. And then other situations where a baby maybe has had what one might think is either nothing traumatic or very little, and kind of be all over the place and quite just very distressed. And one thing that occurs to me is that, like, the way that our nervous systems work, you could say, is to do with context a lot, and meaning. And I think a baby's often, and I know from this from my own experience, that we try and attach meaning to some experience to make sense of it, like to make sense of perhaps whether it's safe or not, but also within a wider context to try and make sense of it. And I think babies do this a lot as well. So the way they interpret something seems to be really important, as opposed to the actual event itself. And I think as therapists, we can often get caught in what happened rather than the baby's experience of it, which is always completely individual, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that's very interesting how you describe it, because we wouldn't normally think of a baby as being able to make sense. And sometimes that's where trauma happens, is when we can't make sense. But I think it sounds like you're saying that given different parameters, like how well bonded the mother is to the baby and vice versa, will help how the baby makes sense of it or doesn't. And perhaps how physically resilient they are based on, you know, the blessings of the ancestors that have built that body, and how able they are to cope with. And then also this piece we were talking about, what kind of things we're here to learn and work through. Not that we ever beckon difficult circumstances ourselves, but sometimes they can have that mixed blessing. So you're right. I think it's very varied, and you're right. There is no textbook assumption about what trauma causes what outcomes. That's for sure. Yeah.
No, because people often ask, don't they? Well, if someone is born with cesarean, will they have certain characteristics, or they've had suction or something? But it doesn't really seem to. I mean, there are, in a certain way, there are. Yeah. Fundamentally not, I don't think.
And I think agree.
It's a bit of a disservice when we try and categorize work like that, I think.
Yeah, and it's tricky writing a book about various imprints and what they will leave. Like my second book called It's Never Too Late, Healing Pre-Birth and Birth at Any Age, I go through really common hospital interventions and the kinds of feelings that babies and mums are left with. And there are themes, there are
definitely,
you know, things that you could look for. But it's always amazing to me how when we go into a healing experience with anyone, what it is that has held them back or hurt them is completely a surprise to
absolutely.
Both of us. Yeah. So you're right.
Yeah. And the other thing that occurs to me is around choice, which I find very interesting as well. Mm. I've noticed that, you know, if you, well, I kind of believe, you know, we have, on some level, you know, we choose to be here, don't we? We choose to incarnate and mm-hmm. perhaps we choose our parents, who knows, but we, mm-hmm. there seems to be some kind of decision at some point is made to incarnate and there are various, if it seems like there are various choices along the way, mm-hmm. like perhaps a choice to implant or a choice mm-hmm. what at what point the birth process will start, as we know, and other things, but it also occurs to me that in our Western approach to birth, a lot of time choice is taken away, mm-hmm. that choice is removed, say for mm-hmm. example in induction. And if we're talking about characteristics of, say, a baby who's been induced, I mean, I don't know if you found this in your experience, but certainly in my experience, a lot of babies who've been induced are quite fractious, and mm-hmm. Their nervous systems tend to be quite wired, understandably, because it's not a particularly pleasant experience that. But also I think and perhaps angry, you know, we can have babies who are quite angry. But I'm just wondering about this thing about choice. Like if, for example, in induction, where that choice of timing is taken away, you know, as adults, when we feel that our choice is taken away, we tend to get very upset, don't we? And very angry. And yeah. I don't know, is this something you've come across, or do you think that's true?
Yeah, again, I like how you name it. I would use would be sovereignty, that we have this in a way, when we talk about a sequence of, say, conception or coming into form, coming into this world, or coming into relationship with mother, growing a limb, you know, all the different gestures we go through in our body, they're all acts of sovereignty and choice, as you say. And I feel that at each step, we have a destination that we're seeking to meet up with. And it's not necessarily predestined, but they're kind of imperatives, developmental imperatives. And that if we're thrown off course or distracted or asked to do it differently than we are aligning to do, we forever want to finish it and complete it. And it is, like you say, induction, babies and children do seem wired and unable to really trust their own pace. And the frustration they feel is being accelerated ahead of themselves, and they can never quite find a sense of catching up. And they'll try to get even about that or reclaim that by being late, by playing with time and playing with agreement or non-agreement. Mm-hmm. And parents think of it as a power struggle, but really it's an attempt to reclaim sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that all of these gestures, they're all kind of moments of meeting up with something divine and something earthly, where if we can sync up with them, we have communion with ourselves and with the other, and we have communion with our bodies, and something just really nourishes and settles in, given the opportunity to complete those moments. So yeah, choice.
And how, Mia, how would you work with that kind of situation then? Maybe as a baby or as an adult?
Mm-hmm. It really does depend on the age, because let's say it's a toddler, which is usually the time parents first notice that this child really wants what they want. You can't always make a child lie down and receive a treatment, because it can feel like the insult all over again. So I often play with them and congratulate them when they make choices, for example, like even children who are called autistic, moving all the time, I really feel like they're trying to reclaim that choice of being able to exit something that's uncomfortable And to when they come back on their own terms, or when they exit when they're uncomfortable, I really celebrate them and congratulate them so that they get the sense that someone's not trying to take that away this time. That's usually the hardest situation to work with for me. And with babies, a lot happens, right? A lot happens just in coming into relationship. And what we do as practitioners with our own bodies and our own nervous systems first, we kind of have to become believable as a safe place first in ourselves. And so settling in and, of course, doing our own work. But, you know, babies are very quick to find goodness for themselves. And if you give them an opportunity, they're very quick to move into completing something that was interrupted for them. Like, I was always amazed that a mother's body, even if she had been through a cesarean, if you start working with the baby and the baby starts finishing the birth gestures that they would have made had they been able to push themselves out, the mother's womb actually picks up again where it left off and begins to contract. And it's like they're both back there giving birth to this new mother and to this baby all over again. And it's just amazing what the body knows how to do given the opportunity.
Yeah. So you're talking quite a lot about like allowing something to complete or finish, aren't you? And, and when things can't complete in different ways, maybe a physical way or an emotional way or a spiritual way, then there's this yearning for some kind of resolution and some hearing. Like often it feels like babies just want to, and mums, everybody actually just wants to tell their story. And there's a completion in that process, isn't it? When something is listened to, right?
Yes. And then those feelings of frustration, whether they are betrayal, rage, grief, they come out in the process sometimes too.
Yeah.
And, but they aren't necessarily like in earlier forms of therapy, the object of the therapy. They're natural outcomes of picking up where we left off.
Yeah. It's interesting this. So when we talking about memory, then I was talking to a friend of mine recently, who I've known for many years, and she had recently gone through a regression where she very spontaneously, like a bit like you described, Mia, went back to a time actually before conception, and where there was she felt she was pushed into incarnation against her will. It was very interesting, and it was very, very clear and very powerful for her. So again, when we're looking at memory, and you know, that I find that so interesting, that clarity can exist even then, you know.
Well, I guess as practitioners, it's our guess that those experiences, even if they're a really long time ago, continue to play out in ways in our adult life.
Yeah,
it's my sense that at conception, if there is reluctance of any kind or a barrier of any sort, it's going to show up in how we start all of our tasks and how we start all of our sequences even now. And it seems like a lot of people come to this work because their present life is frustrating them. Or getting bogged down at certain stages of relationship or certain stages of activity. And so when we look back at, say, conception, which we think of as a beginning, we can see that that's a really showing up all over through life. And it is amazing that people can remember. And I'm thinking about something you said at the beginning of our conversation, that that there's choice over and over again to come into this world, to come into relationship. And I find that, you know, some of the imprints we carry, sometimes they're so scary and so devastating. And a lot of people are feeling like, given the opportunity, they don't know if they can do the healing work, because to go through those feelings might mean something that they're not willing to contend with, like maybe the feeling that they will die. I like to remind people that it must be that they're meant to be here, because if you did make it here, you would have had to have kept choosing.
Yeah.
And something would have kept choosing you as well. Some spiritual dimension, a parent, someone would have had to have agreed to that choice. And to lean back on that and rely on that is a very powerful resource that we don't always remember is there.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my clients describes that as, you know, she describes herself as a survivor, not as a victim. She's a, you know, you're here because you've survived all this. Which is a great way of looking at it. So I know your course is going to be in three parts, isn't it? Could you just describe what each part will cover, Mia, in the course? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're talking about these trajectories and these choices and these developmental imperatives. And I find myself endlessly fascinated about the very first couple weeks of pregnancy, the first couple weeks of gestation, because of their power to influence the rest of our lives so greatly. And so we're breaking the course into three major subjects, the first one being conception and all of the possible dynamics and ways of describing what conception could be like if things were ideal, and acknowledging some very common things that can happen if conception isn't ideal, and the whys, and then some of what it might feel like to go through a conception that has interruptive qualities, so that we can actually then start to bring in a more coherent and a whole resonant field of conception, a kind of feeling of what it would be like if all had gone really well, even if it didn't, and together resonating with that and doing some developmental exercises around that, and taking questions from the group and working individually a bit. And then the idea would be to go in the next week to what would be happening developmentally a week later, which would be coming into relationship now as a multicellular being with our mothers for the first time at implantation, and doing something similar, talking about how that can be interrupted, what it can feel like when it's been interrupted, like how that shows up in your adult life. And then bringing in a developmental gesture that mimics and invokes what a whole or coherent implantation could be like, and taking questions. And then in the third week, we'll go to probably what would be the next week in developmental time, which would be being discovered, if your mother was or available to know that she was pregnant, what that would be like, how did that go, ways it can be interrupted, and then a coherent gesture around it and questions.
Cool. Wonderful.
Yeah.
And I was reading recently that I think the statistics are that something like half of all conceptions in the US are not planned. And I'm just wondering how do you see that playing out in society, that level of unconscious coming into this world?
Yeah. Well, like you said, no two embryos or babies are going to go through the experience with the same outcome. And so I've experienced people describing being a surprise, but sensing that they were coming between two people who really loved each other, and they could feel the love and the sort of unconditional welcomeness of all things, and that they did well, despite maybe not being intentionally welcomed. And I've experienced people who had parents who really wanted a child and were totally intended for, but had troubles because of undigested grief and events that preceded them. So we never really know, but something that came to my mind when you said that statistic, I didn't know that statistic, was I wonder if that's to helps explain why everyone wants to be so famous and so visible. Right. Like maybe we're trying to replace some kind of missing sense of importance and belonging by, you know, really making ourselves wildly visible at all times.
Yes, I mean, maybe that's true. I mean, I have thought, because I've, you know, with my kids, and you know, it's interesting, the dynamic now, because yes, there's the whole thing about being visible, and there is also the thing about being watched, I think, as well. Like, I remember when I was growing up, you could do all kinds of stuff without anybody kind of knowing, or you know what I mean? But like, particularly if you're in a group. But now, like, there's a constant feeling that you could, that a camera could be switched on, you're a photograph taken of you, or an audio recording, you know, in terms of like your freedom to express yourself. There's a thing about, you know, constantly being watched, which is very, very different these days, I think.
Mm-hmm. And what do you notice in your kids and their peers, how that changes things?
Yeah. I don't know. It's difficult. I feel some sadness around it, actually, that pressure is on. That, you know, it's, I think kids need a feeling that they're not constantly being watched, in order to really feel into expression, self-expression, without mm-hmm. the feeling that they're being watched or judged somehow by their peers or parents.
Being watched can be a feeling of being in communion, but it could also be of scrutiny, and you're right, there's a difference. And
being
witnessed is a deluxe feeling when you're a baby. That's all that we want, as long as it's attuned watching.
So you talked about discovery. Some people might not be familiar with that term. Could you just describe that a little bit, Mia?
Yeah, it's a term that Ray Castellino and William Emerson and I think Peter Levine coined quite a while ago, probably in the 80s, as a step in a sequence. And the sequence, main sequence, being conception, implantation, discovery. And so discovery is, as it sounds, where your mother's pregnant and she knows or she doesn't know, and how does the world change around you? How does her life and her way of being with you come alive or not when she knows you're there? And I worked with one woman, for example, whose mother was in denial that she was pregnant and waited just really 6 months into pregnancy before she could acknowledge that she was pregnant, and how hard that was, how devastating that was on this, you know, new consciousness that came for love. And but most people know when they miss their period, which would be, you know, sometime 2 weeks or 3 weeks later after conception. But everyone has different experiences around it. A mother who's busy with her children and her partner, if he's not supportive or she's not supportive, may feel like, oh no, what am I going to do with another kid? And some woman maybe have been waiting for years and this is a miracle. So it's always different for each person. And some people are told a story and yet they feel something else was true. Mm-hmm. And we always trust what the person feels because that's their camera angle of the event. That's what matters. So we work with whatever the memory is of that time.
Yeah, wonderful. And when we come to this thing about, you know, birth, being able to, you could heal anything, and well, at any time, or the impacts of how we come into this world can be healed, right? I'm intrigued about that because there are certain kind of levels to it, aren't there? There are psychological, emotional, spiritual aspects to it. And then there's also perhaps how our nervous system responds. And I'm interested from my own experience and my own kind of struggles with some of this stuff, is that one can sometimes understand what happened and hold it in a big context of compassion or understanding of why these things happened. And at the same time, the early imprints can be very, very strong and sometimes quite overwhelming in one's nervous system. And like going into overwhelm, going into freeze, going into fight or flight or panic or whatever it is in certain situations later. And so those things, one can hold them, but they're still there often, aren't they?
Yeah.
So we're not trying to change that. I mean, those imprints in our nervous system are pretty strong, aren't they? Or can be pretty strong.
Yeah, I would say the earlier we're imprinted, the more global the effect on our system. And so you're right that we can have the narrative and we could have the details and even the compassion for ourselves and our even our family, but the work of retraining our system or even simply sitting with it as it is when it's arising, it seems to live longer than the content itself. And there are a lot of techniques that work from the outside in. So they'll start with retraining your nervous system with no sense of the content of what's caused your nervous system to be dysregulated or necessarily any detailed work about it, let alone body work. And I think they can help a little, but I think what we're doing is we're coming into the center, into the being, into the relational being, and working from the deepest core of things and trusting that as that starts to settle, so do the sort of outer realms. And I've often been amazed, like you're saying, at how really a body of work it is to come into a trusting relationship with our own bodies and how we interact with the environment. And it does take time. Some things that are challenging just poof, disappear like in a moment, and some things are surprisingly like needing a lot of revisiting.
Yeah.
And I think definitely blending modalities is helpful too.
Yeah. Is this kind of where your this intuitive recovery project comes in? Is that kind of around this?
Yeah, it's one way in to the conversation. There are so many roads into healing, and people often say, should I do this modality or should I do this technique and see this kind of practitioner? And I just feel like as long as you're moving towards yourself, it really doesn't matter what you use. So when I wrote that sequence down in the book, in The Secret Life of Babies, it was just one example of how to gently begin to form a relationship with these young places in our nervous systems. With the trust that even though we don't have the brain architecture to support consciousness at those times, we could still communicate with that piece in us that's still alive.
Yeah.
So it's a six-step process that lovingly and gently takes the reader through maybe some first steps of how to come into contact with themselves at that level. And then the next book goes into more detail with that at these stages that we're talking about.
Cool. We're going to open up for questions in a minute from the people who are on there. I just want one last question about the course. Is it, would you say you're offering some skills for practitioners in this course that they can bring into their work with mums and babies?
Yeah, I think that I like to make the work really accessible. And so lay people who want to work with their children or their families or practitioners who want to work with their clients could really take what we do in these 3 weeks and implement it right away with, let's say, pregnant women who maybe want to make contact with their babies or to their adult clients who are healing these stages of their lives. And whether you're a body worker or more dialogue type based therapist, I think that they fit with each modality.
Yeah, cool. All right, so we'll open up for questions, and there's a couple here already, so I'll just field those. And if there's any on Facebook, perhaps Leisha could get them up for us as well. There's one from DP. I can say that induction also manifested in me as me feeling, which is not a feeling, like I just want to slap you if you tell me to hurry up, especially if you're my mother, which of course I never did. But the agitation is there, and now I know where that came from. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how it makes me think when I hear that statement about sort of the loss that the mother has too when she is administered birth interventions, because those birth interventions get between her and her baby. And it's really apt that the baby is mad, not just at the experience, but at the mom, because as far as they can tell, this came from them too, or came from the world, which is the mother. And it really can affect the bond with creating this affect between you, where there's a power struggle of not quite fast enough, you're going too fast, you're going too slow. And, you know, even a mother who really loves their child can't figure out sometimes why their child won't really bond with them. And it's an unfortunate thing that it sits between them, the drug, the injury, the whatever it is. Now, I don't know if in DP's case, that's the case. And there may be other reasons of what goes on between that person and their mother, but it's a loss for both.
Yeah. And maybe there might be a sense of feeling of being deprived of a very precious experience, mm-hmm. maybe. I certainly Absolutely. Come across this with, you know, we talk about twin loss, right? And mm-hmm. Some survivors of twin loss can feel like, or it feels like they, apart from the element of loss, but there's almost a kind of resentment that they've been deprived of something very, very mm-hmm. special. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that can happen in these circumstances as well.
Yeah.
So Caro is asking, Mia, you said that you work with whatever memory is there from that time. What if there was no memory, or in other words, consciously there's no memory? I understand there is memory in the body, and how would that be accessed? That's an interesting mm-hmm. question. It's
well,
a big question.
it's right. So it makes sense what you're saying. And very, very, very few people have conscious memory of birth and pre-birth. I haven't met too many who can say in regular conversation that, oh yeah, I remember when I was born, the doctor this and my mom that. And so it makes sense, and it's normal and common. And the way that we access it is we don't even necessarily go looking, because I like to try to practice without being willful, without necessarily fishing for things or making something happen. But if it so happened that you were, say, in a session with me, we would start to talk, and you may say something that sounds reminiscent of birth. Like you may say something like, you know, in my adult life, I don't know how to feel connected to people, or I always feel like there's a barrier between me and my child, or something. I'm just making this up. And so I might ask, oh, do you know anything about your birth? And, you know, I would wonder, oh, was anyone given an anesthetic? And we would just start a conversation. And if you were in the same room with me and we were having you say on the craniosacral table, another way memory comes up isn't just through language, but it's through what your body is doing. And you may find yourself wanting to pull into a certain position, or your body always feels like it's tight in a certain way. And if I put my hands on you and followed your body's intelligence, which is an easy, short way of saying what's a very long process, we may discover that you feel like you're in the womb, or you feel like someone's pulling on you or rushing you, or whatever it could be. So there's a few different ways it can happen. And I'm always surprised and never really know how we'll go, but if it's meant to come up, it will.
Yeah, cool. Indra is asking, how important is it to know the history of your birth from your mother to bring in the healing of birth? I feel knowing the history would influence my mind more than trusting my soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can happen. Sometimes when we're told how it is, we may think that we have to align our experience with the external narrative. And it's always most important to follow your soul and to follow your intuition and follow your body, because a lot of times, all the time, nobody knows what it's like for you in the womb. Nobody knows what it's like for you at birth. Only you, and you're the authority on that. So we trust you above all other written or remembered tales about it.
Yeah, sure. DP is asking, did you do Ray Castellina's practitioner course or Myna Martin's?
Ray was a mentor of mine, and I didn't study his course. I did some study with Myrna. Most of my study has been with the people who I've worked with and my own healing journey.
Sure. Mark is asking, thank you. On the topic of preconception and implantation, do you explore or consider some challenges that are chosen by one's lessons within an incarnation? Is that clear, that question?
Maybe, could you read it again?
Yeah, it wasn't clear to me.
I have the gist of it, but maybe one more time would be helpful.
On the topic of preconception and implantation, do you explore or consider some challenges are chosen by one's lessons within an incarnation, i.e. characteristics of autism as one example?
So what I think I'm understanding is, do we choose our challenges?
I think it's
a touchy subject. My husband and I talk about this all the time, that in a lot of spiritual communities, there's a lot of talk about, oh, you chose this suffering, therefore you should be grateful to those that hurt you, or you chose this lot in life. There's no sense being angry. Let's just hold it with compassion and own it. And it's a slippery slope for me. I feel that truly, at least in the birth milieu, many people hurt babies when they don't have to. And I like to put the responsibility, let's say, onto the other who's caused the harm, that they caused it. Not that we came here with a sign that said, please do this to me. It's important not to be a victim, but it's also important not to swing all the way to the other side and not hold other people responsible for their actions. And so I think at a very, very refined level of soul, and on levels that I don't think we're really meant to understand, we're here to work something, certainly. But I think the degree to which we hurt each other as human beings is unnecessary and can be avoided with education and with healing. And so I would not say that all that befalls us was what we came for. I think that that's, in a way, letting people off the hook.
Yeah. So in terms of getting this message more out there, because it seems like, I know there's a lot more talk about it these days, but there is still this kind of understanding or lack of understanding about babies' consciousness and about not just that they remember pain, but actually how aware they are and how exquisitely sensitive they are. Do you think just this awareness, because I when I was many, many years ago, I used to work with an obstetrician and in a clinic, and we used to have conversations, and we were talking about, for example, the effect of suction on babies. And he admitted he'd never really thought about it. It wasn't just the painful nature of it, which is incredibly painful, but also the structural ramifications. And this was someone who was very, very sensitive. So I suppose what I'm asking is, why do you think there is this kind of blind spot with people about this, about the exquisite sensitivity of babies? Why do you think we assume that babies don't remember anything, or they, you know, they can go through these kind of experiences that we would never inflict on an adult?
Yeah, I think it's a long piece of research about history and a worthwhile line of inquiry, right? Because, you know, how many thousands of years has it been that we haven't trusted the woman's body? How many thousands of years have we stopped trusting the earth as providing for us and as being the feminine mother of life? And, you know, if we really go back and ask the question, it leads to more questions and cultural questions and historical questions and, you know, stories about dominance and stories about the earth. And I think that it's difficult, even for me, to imagine what someone else might need if I was never given it. You can't really feed until you've been truly fed. And so if an obstetrician, even in their sensitivity and their kindness and their willingness to serve the mother, the mother writ large, if they have been denied a moment of contact at their own birth, they may not know that there is something more to offer. And maybe many of us get into this work to rediscover what we missed. And maybe the obstetrician is no different than any of us coming at it through the medical model instead. And I think, you know, one of my other mentors, Andrew Feldmar, he's from Hungary. And you know, the culture of birth in Hungary is still very, very hurt. And still behaving in that imprinted way of the Cold War. And, you know, he really goes so far to say that the OBs there, the ones who aren't tending to the babies, are unwilling to give something that they have not yet had. In other words, they would be jealous for someone else to actually get a good experience. So I think there's a whole range of benevolence to malevolence in birth and in life. And the act of this healing work is a real reclamation work of the earth as well, and of our histories as people, and the masculine and the feminine, the marriage, you know, it's a big shift.
That's great. Thank you. Becky is asking, I've heard someone else use the term fetal therapist, where one starts caring for mum in utero. What's your experience of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really common. It's brilliant, really, that we can close the gap between what we need and what's missing. If a mother is suffering or preoccupied or toxic in any way, then as a baby, if you want to live, what would you have to do? You have to, in your mind, supply something that's missing. And if you feel your mother's not okay, then obviously you're not going to be okay. If you want to live, we sadly take on the belief that we could carry both of us. You know, that I can carry my mom, I can carry myself. Of course, it's not true, but we try. We take less or we supply more. And it becomes a habit in life where it's very difficult to let someone else take care of us. And so that habit can be changed. And it's sad when we realize how hard we've been working, and it's very common.
Just two more questions, if that's all right. Cara is saying, do you see a connection with patterns or in injuries in your life connected to birth, pre-birth? We kind of started with that question, didn't we? E.g. a pattern on one side of the body. Yeah, we had that conversation at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, it's not always the case, but a lot of times we do see the mother's lineage show up on the left side of our bodies, that the way we relate with the feminine ancestry tends to show up on the left side, but it's not always the case. And I don't know if you find that too, John, but the masculine shows up sometimes on the right, and or, you know, relationship to the father. But I've often seen it sort of flip at times too, where things aren't always linear like that, but it's not uncommon.
Okay, so here's an interesting question, challenging question. Do you know much about one's sexuality can come from womb experience? I have sensed as a male, personally, some homosexual feelings have come from womb experience. Anything to say about that at all?
I'm really interested in that comment and question. I wondered too. It's very politically touchy to wonder in some ways too, right? One thing I do think a lot about is when there's a very strong longing for the child to be of one sex or another, sometimes I think that can shape one's orientation to how one should dress or be in the world. And in terms of sexual preference rather than gender, it's a very complex thing. And I think each person knows for themselves. So I would say to the person who asked, that whatever you're sensing, I would trust yourself and follow the line of inquiry. And it would be great to be able to speak in person to see what exactly that is that's coming up. But like we say, there's no textbook approach. But I would say that everything that's happening in the womb and ancestrally before us is relevant, and some things we resonate more with and some less.
Good. Okay. We should probably tie it up there. Any last things you want to say, Mia, before we stop around the course and anything else?
I would just say that it's my privilege to connect with you and your community, and that I'm really looking forward to seeing what emerges between us all in the weeks to come. And just thank you for the space and the invitation.
No, thank you so much, Mia. So Mia Kilev's talk course starts on the 1st of March, and you can get details at ourbirthjourney.com. So that's ourbirthjourney.com. So please do join us there. And thank you so much, Mia, for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Great. Thank you.